The idea today that I'd like to discuss is the notion of incarnation in Jewish thought. And on the face of this, I think it sounds a little surprising or shocking. Incarnation in Jewish thought, right? That seems surprising. I think we associate the notion of incarnation, especially the word, is used in Christian discourse. And it's associated with certain Christian ideas. But when we think about what really distinguishes, especially medieval Judaism, pre-modern Judaism, from Christianity, I don't think it's specifically the question of incarnation. It's actually the question of Christology. So I want to distinguish those two. We'll talk about the difference between incarnation and Christology. Here's a little thought experiment for us. When I say incarnation, what comes to mind? So when I just say they use the word incarnation as an idea, give me some sense of what comes to mind for you. What associations do you have? What does it evoke? Yes. So you start to think of reincarnation. We'll get there to that question. What else do you think of? Yes. Something. Okay, something entering the mind, or I guess entering the body. Yeah. Okay, we think of transformation. Yes.
All the Hindu incarnations, Rama and Shiva and all those other people.
Where it's gods or elements of actually Atman, but elements of this sort of universal divinity that then becomes manifest in the body in some sense. In fact, what incarnation from carna, carne, Latin word, what does that mean? Meat, right? Flesh, the body. And the notion of incarnation is the idea of the divine being made manifest in the body. But where this really becomes meaningful in Christianity is the notion of the divine being manifest in the body of Christ. And within that, the importance of Christian incarnation is actually centered around the notion of Christology, namely the idea that God is made uniquely manifest in the body of Jesus in order to redeem humanity thereby. It is a unique event. It is also often described as a miraculous event, the result of a virgin birth, and that this then creates the opportunity for human salvation. And this is something that is centered around one body, around a unique body, the body of Christ. This is the incarnational doctrine. Judaism and Christianity were in very close engagement in the Middle Ages, and they often conflicted with each other, they criticized each other's ideas, and they in fact formulated their own discourse. Jewish discourses and Christian discourses grew up in the Middle Ages, involved very intimately with one another. In fact, the versions of Christianity that emerge from the pre-modern world and take the form after the Protestant Reformation, in what we call Protestant Christianity in its various forms, and Catholicism, this is the result of a long-standing conversation and dispute between Christianity and Judaism in Europe. And in many ways, Christianity and Judaism are formulated in the pre-modern world through an engagement, often a very tense engagement with one another. And there's some sociological research that makes a compelling case that religious traditions that are engaged in dispute with one another end up with what we call a discursive transfer. And the notion of discursive transfer is that discourses, ideas, ways of talking about a particular religion and its identity become sort of shared as groups conflict with one another and argue with one another. We often think, I think it's easy to imagine that religious groups that argue with one another, that conflict with one another, don't share ideas in common. But what we actually see over the course of history is that religions that are engaged in conflict with one another actually end up sharing ideas, and they formulate their conceptions of themselves utilizing the terminology of the other with whom they're arguing. And they actually start to become kind of mirrors for one another. In fact, part of the way that you know you're yourself is sometimes through the formulation of a self that is different than the other, against whom that self is being created. So in some ways, pre-modern Judaism and Christianity are formulated in terms of not being one another. But this then creates an opportunity where certain ideas become reflected in both traditions, just in different ways. Incarnation, the notion of the divine being made manifest in the human body, is one such idea that emerges from the pre-modern world, where Judaism and Christianity each have their own version of this idea, but it means something different and it's formulated differently within those religious traditions. In the pre-modern world, Jews couldn't be ignorant of Christianity. What I mean by that is it wasn't really a possibility for them to not know what Christian discourse about Judaism was. It was almost impossible to avoid. In the modern, or especially in the contemporary pluralistic environment, the luxury of pluralism is the ability to be ignorant about other people. And interestingly, open pluralistic environments that are not hot environments where people are engaged in polemical dispute with one another, but are in fact cold environments, meaning there's very little critique of the other happening in that environment, that creates a moment for people to be very ignorant of the religions that are around them. A great example of this is occasionally on the first day of a religion class, I'll say, generally I have a certain number of students in my Jewish studies class who are Jewish. And to illustrate this point about how pluralistic, cold environments, which are the best kind to live in, it means people don't have to deal with the tense problems of religious dispute, lead to a kind of ignorance about the people around us. And so I'll ask my students, I'll have a certain number, let's say a third of the class will be Jewish, and I'll ask them some basic questions about Christianity, just to illustrate that they don't know the answers to those basic questions, and often because they don't need to. So I'll ask them, what is Christmas? What is Christmas about? And often the students will kind of scratch their heads, and I had one who said, well, I'm sure it's about Christianity. And I said, yes! What else is it about? And I remember I had these two students, who was a Jewish, young Jewish man, and he was there with his friend from his fraternity who was a Christian. And he said, wait a second, Christmas, does that involve the pilgrims? And I said, no, that's Thanksgiving. And his friend, his non-Jewish friend sitting next to him said, oh, what a schmuck. Which I thought was pretty funny. So Yiddish is known by Christians in America, but in fact, finally we did get them to the idea that Christmas celebrates, has something to do with the birth of Jesus and Bethlehem, the star, and of course this is actually a class taking place in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. But how is it that these Jewish kids from New Jersey and New York don't know anything about Christianity? They're living in a country that is majority Christian. It's around them, it's on the radio. How come they don't know this? And the answer is that they don't have to. And in fact, there's something kind of nice about living in a pluralistic environment where there isn't an exchange of polemic. There isn't an exchange of mutual critique between religions. We kind of leave each other alone in a pluralistic environment. This means that probably Judaism and Christianity are then able to formulate conceptions of themselves in this environment that are less dependent on the criticism of the other in figuring out the self. But in the pre-modern world, this was not the case, and the criticism of the other was always there. So when we think about medieval critiques of Judaism by Christianity, there the critique was always that Jews are blind to the true inner meaning of their scripture. This is why synagoga and ecclesia are represented the way they are. My apologies to people who have heard this in the previous talk, but in this, the representations of ecclesia, the sort of statue representation of the church, and synagoga, the iconic representation of Judaism, of the synagogue, they're both princesses or queens, but the synagogue, the crown has fallen from her head, the tablets of the law have fallen from her hands, her staff is broken, meaning she once had a period where she ruled, but now that period is done. And this is a way of kind of representing in medieval art the notion that Judaism is a religion that is passé. It's over. Its time has passed. It had its moment, but now it has been superseded by ecclesia, superseded by the church. This is the doctrine of supersession. But also, synagogue is represented as blind. She's blindfolded. She can't see. The idea that Jews can't see the truth of Jesus that is represented in the Old Testament as Christians read it. And it's a dispute about who really can see the truth of Scripture. And there's also the critique that Judaism is carnal, meaning that Judaism places too much emphasis on the practice of the law and the practice of the law with the body. Because Jewish law regulates physical activities more than intellectual ones. It doesn't really regulate belief. It regulates laws regarding the Sabbath, laws regarding holidays, laws regarding food restrictions, which became one of the most obvious distinctions between Jews and Christians in the Middle Ages. What do people do with their bodies? Jews eat differently. Jews pray differently. Jews celebrate holidays differently with their bodies. And they circumcise themselves. So these physical actions were understood as very carnal, meaning very much of the body. And the critique was that Judaism is carnal as opposed to Christianity, which is spiritual. Now, without Jews there in the Middle Ages, I'm not sure they would have formulated a conception of Christianity in quite that way. The body is actually fairly important in the Christian tradition. But the notion of the spiritual Christianity is formulated in light of the idea of the carnal Judaism in its midst. At the same time, Jews are thinking through their own conception of themselves. And one of the things we find is Jews elevating the notion of the body as being the vehicle for the spiritual. And this reflects a long-standing difference between the Greco-Roman ideal represented in the Christian notion of what personhood is, and then the largely Semitic, ancient Semitic idea in the Jewish notion of what personhood is. And the question is, what is a person? Is a person a spirit? What is the actual essence of a person? So in the Greco-Roman heritage, which broadly speaking is then manifest in Christianity in the Middle Ages, the notion of the self is articulated as a spirit, meaning the essence of a person is their soul. And the body is merely the shell that houses, or even literally imprisons, the self. And the idea is to liberate the soul. And the body is the shell, the husk, the thing that ultimately should be negated as much as possible. The more a person negates their body, the more godly and spiritual they are. And this idea actually becomes more emphasized in the 12th and 13th centuries with the development of the ideal of monasticism and more emphasis placed on the idea of celibacy, that to be a celibate, single, especially male body, removed from the world as much as possible, with the body and its pleasures denied as much as possible, this is the highest state of sanctity and the best way to approach the divine. It created a world in which then you have special people, the clergy, who are celibate, who are more spiritual than the average person. And the clergy then become religiously elevated. The leadership of the Christian church in the Middle Ages becomes closer to God than the average person, because the average person is more trapped in their body than the leaders who are celibate and who are on this higher level of sanctity. In the Semitic vision of the self that's represented in Talmudic and then medieval Judaism, selfhood is actually very different. Selfhood is a soul and a body together. The notion of what is a Jewish self for rabbis in the Talmud is essentially what we call an ensouled body, meaning a body with a soul in it capable of performing commandments. And that sanctity is accomplished not through the negation of the body. Rather, sanctity is developed by the work of the body itself. and that when bodies perform mitzvot, they render themselves and the world more sacred. And that greater sanctity that's developed in the physical world is part of the goal of the path of halacha, creating a sanctified world, a sanctified self, a sanctified community is done with the body, not simply with the soul. And therefore, on the whole, the pleasures of the body and the actions of the body are all potentially sanctified. So celibacy is not permitted in rabbinic Judaism. It's a mitzvah to get married and to have children. And there are many mitzvot that are accomplished through eating, through drinking wine, and through communal togetherness. Furthermore, the notion of rabbinic leadership is that the rabbi simply helps the community know about the law, in sort of as a kind of instruction to help the community think through the things they need to know and that they need to do with their bodies in order to bring sanctity into the world. Rabbis are not considered on a higher level of sanctity in medieval Judaism in the sense that Christian clergy are. The idea is that the rabbi is subject to the same laws as everybody else. There's nothing special about the rabbi. Sorry, rabbi. There's nothing different. The rabbi is not different in their being, in their spirituality than anyone else in the medieval rabbinic and in the ancient rabbinic system. It's a more horizontal structure rather than a vertical one with a hierarchy and religious leadership at the top and people in lower levels of sanctity below. The rabbinic system is more horizontal, where rabbis are simply members of the community. They have the same responsibility to halacha as everyone else, and they all perform the same functions with their body. They all get married, they all observe the law, and they all pursue halacha for bringing sanctity into the world. So in many ways, medieval Jewish thinkers embraced this notion that the body was a vehicle for bringing sanctity into the world and not an impediment for attaining contact with sanctity that is beyond this world. The physical is more elevated in the rabbinic system. But when we get to the question of the Middle Ages and the critiques directed against Judaism as the carnal religion par excellence, there became a need to articulate a stronger response and a more direct response to this question of what is the role of the body in the Jewish way of life, and how do they respond to the Christian critiques of Judaism, which were very loud and very public, that Judaism is too carnal. And I think one of the most interesting articulations of this is developed in the Kabbalistic literature that we start to see developing in Spain in the 13th century. So just very quickly, because I know a lot of you weren't at the first few talks, and I apologize for a few of you who were, Kabbalah is also often called Jewish mysticism. It's also perhaps best described as being Jewish esotericism, the idea of a secret doctrine within Judaism. And we start to see texts that talk about this in the late 12th into the 13th century. And suddenly in Spain, especially in the region of Castile in the late 1200s, Kabbalah really takes off. And we find the development of hundreds of texts that describe the Kabbalistic worldview. And even though it's described as secret, they often mark it as a secret in order to really enhance its popularity, right? Nothing sells as well as a secret. If you tell people, I've got a secret, I'm not sure I should tell you. Who doesn't want to know that, right? It's a great, whenever we see esoteric doctrines in religious traditions, and all Western religious traditions have them, it doesn't mean that that doctrine was known to only a few people. Often, ideas that are called secrets become known by many people because they're desirable by virtue of being called a secret. And so the Kabbalistic idea is actually very simple. It's the notion that the infinite, unknowable part of God is called Ein Sof, meaning the endless, or that which has no end, the infinite, and that from God there emanates 10 aspects of himself, called the 10 sfirot, coming from the word sapir, which means luminous or light, also for the word to narrate or to count. These are the 10 aspects of God that are luminous yet invisible. They are intangible. They are not physical. And they're called spherot, but not the Greek word spheres. They're not round orbs. They're the 10 aspects of God that emanate down from the world of Ein Sof, and from the 10th one called the Shekhinah, the divine presence, or Malchut, divine kingdom. This is the most feminine of the divine aspects. This is where the physical world comes from. So it's Ein Sof, then Sfirot, then the physical world. And it's a process of emanation, not really of creation. Meaning the idea is that the world, the physical world as we know it, is actually part of the same substance, or at least on a continuum of being with God. It's emanated from God, not created. So the world is in some ways, everything in it is connected to God. Everything is part of the same great chain of being. But in particular, in the Kabbalistic doctrine of the Middle Ages, they argue that the soul, especially the Jewish soul, and here they were very ethnocentric. They didn't apologize for this. Christians said that Christians were different kinds of human beings. Muslims said that Muslims were different kinds of human beings. And Jews say it as well in the Middle Ages. Jews argue that the soul emanates into Jews from Ein Sof. It comes from Ein Sof through the Sefirot and into the self, the body of every individual Jew. And in that respect, they say, Jews are actually manifesting God in the world through their bodies, right? And bodies, what are bodies made of? Flesh, carne, they're carnal. So I think it's fair to call this an idea of Jewish incarnation. The idea that Jews manifest God in their bodies in a special, unique way. But, of course, it's not just one person manifesting God in the sort of system that's more horizontal that we would expect in a rabbinic culture. Every Jew manifests God with their bodies. Every Jew manifests God with their bodies, according to the medieval Kabbalists, which is kind of like saying, yes, Christian critics of Judaism, Judaism is a carnal religion, but that's because each Jew is like Christ. Each Jew is a manifestation of God in the world. Each Jew performing commandments accomplishes great things because the bodies are a special vehicle for bringing sanctity into the world, for fulfilling God's will, and the Kabbalists go one step further. They argue that Jewish bodies are able to influence God. In the study of religion, we call this idea theurgy. It's the idea that human actions can influence the divine realm. And so what the Kabbalists argue is that when Jews perform commandments like the Sabbath, when they perform commandments like marriage and reproduction, that was one they gave a lot of attention to, they argue this is not Jews being carnal, feeding their bodies, resting their bodies, praying with their bodies, performing commandments with their bodies, wearing fringes, wearing phylacteries, tefillin. This isn't just them being too focused on the body and not focused on the soul. It's that their body-soul combination manifests God in the world, and therefore when they perform mitzvot, they impact God. They draw the sefirot together to one another, bringing the light of Ein Sof through the sefirot into the world, and they argue that if Jews don't do this, the world will cease to exist. That Jews actually keep the universe together. And in the absence of that, the universe could not exist. It's a very heroic image of what Jews are and what Jews are doing. And they do it with their body. They do it with their body. This is a radical departure in some ways from Talmudic Judaism. In Talmudic Judaism, of course, the body is very important. But there isn't an idea that the soul is divine. That we really don't see until the 13th century. Nachmanides and others start to talk about it, and the Kabbalists talk about it quite a bit. So that part is actually different from Rabbinic Judaism. But the part that's the same is the idea that Jews reflect the body of God, and that God can be understood as maybe not having a tangible body, but as having a spiritual body. Both the Bible and the Talmud did not have a problem with anthropomorphism, representing God in terms of the human form. They were actually fine with that. In the Talmud, they talk about God wearing tefillin each day. They talk about God crying over the death of the righteous and over the destruction of the temple, that God weeps. They also describe God as roaring like a lion. They talk about God interacting with prophets and with rabbis. And they also talk about God, in Tractate Sanhedrin, continuing the act of creation each day. There's a famous agadic passage, a famous story in the Talmud when they say, since God created the world, what is he doing? And they say, well, he renews the act of creation every day. And how does he do it? Does anyone know this story? Yes, he's a matchmaker, saying this person for this person and this person for this person. And Kabbalists love that passage. They cite it a lot. And they say, yes, indeed, the continuation of the act of creation is performed by Jewish marriages, by Jews coming together, creating more Jews, right? What are they talking about? The coupling of Jewish bodies to create more Jewish bodies, who will then continue the cycle of Jewish bodies in the world. And what they argue is, yes, that's what causes the world to continue to exist. But think about the environment where medieval Kabbalists are emphasizing these ideas. What's at stake in the medieval life that Jews are grappling with is what is the place of the Jewish body in the society in which they live. They're suffering expulsions. They have no political autonomy. In fact, the Jewish body is the property of the king. Jews belong to someone else. So politically, economically, the Jewish body was always a question, and Jews were always trying to manage where the Jewish body will fit. Theologically, it's another question. What's the purpose of the Jewish body in medieval Christendom? Do they serve a function anymore, or should they be expelled? This was a question. And are Jewish bodies the perfect example of the rejection of Christ and the lack of sanctity? This was one of the critiques directed against Judaism by medieval Christians, that Jews actually represent unholiness because they are too physical. And the Kabbalistic response, the Jewish response in the Middle Ages, is that actually the Jewish body is the unique and special vehicle of divinity in the world, that Jews are like gods among men. Jews are like special in the realm of humanity. And by doing the things that they do, the religious practices that they perform, they actually keep the world going for everyone. They are the secret unsung heroes of the cosmos, according to medieval Jewish discourse. It's a response. It articulates a response to a very pointed Christian critique of Jews being too physical and not spiritual. And the argument is the spiritual is the physical, and that the Jewish body is the unique vehicle for bringing the spiritual into the world and actually for continuing the existence of the world. They affirm the physicality of Judaism. In a sense, they kind of, to use a gambling metaphor, they double down on the notion of the physical, of the carnal, and elevate it as a spiritual practice. There's a couple of really interesting examples in Kabbalistic literature that I just want to sort of cite that describe this notion of the specialness of the human or the Jewish body, how it alludes to the form of God, and how this renders Judaism and the practice of Judaism with the body as a very unique thing. So one Kabbalist from the Middle Ages, from medieval Spain, named Yosef of Hamadan, says that the people of Israel is the essence of the universe, for they allude to the pure and holy supernal form, meaning that they refer to the form of God as represented in the spherot. They have the idea that the spherot are all manifest in the form of a human body, and that this is, in a sense, the divine form, and that the Jewish body on earth is a reflection of this divine body, this divine form in heaven. There's another really interesting passage in an anonymous text that I found that's still in manuscript form. It's unpublished, but there was lots and lots of this kind of literature being written in medieval Spain that had a big impact on later forms of Judaism. And this text says the following. It says, "The Creator is a living essence, resembling the appearance of a soul and its form in a human body, though composed of spiritual light, like spirit or air, having form but no physical body. In this manner, the Holy One, blessed be he, exists, resembling, yet not resembling, the human. Heaven forbid that he has no form or image, However, it is an image that is entirely like a soul in the configuration of a body. In this manner, he can be envisioned through the spirot. And one who desires to understand this should contemplate that which is subtle and essential, but not tangible. And since the Holy One, blessed be he, pours forth blessings into all of the spherot, and all of the spherot draw from his power, he is seen by means of them, and he exceeds them and is exalted beyond them, such that there is no end to his loftiness. And this is the meaning of, like the appearance of a man upon it from above, the passage from Ezekiel 1:26, talking about the appearance of God in the chariot vision in the heavens. And the text says, not a tangible man, but a spiritual one. So this notion of the spiritual divine body, reflected in the form of the ten spherot, is then taken by Kabbalists as a way for understanding the purpose of the performance of all of the commandments and the purpose for the Jewish people in the world. The Zohar, citing a rabbinic passage, the Sefer HaZohar, or Book of Splendor, of course, being one of the most popular Kabbalistic books to emerge from the Middle Ages. It eventually becomes, sort of takes its place alongside the Bible and the Talmud as the most important of Jewish texts. And the Zohar says the following. It cites Zechariah 2:10. It says, for I have spread you forth as the four directions of the heavens, meaning the sort of the exile of the Jewish people into the land of the Israel, into the lands of exile outside of Israel. And the Zohar goes on to explain this passage to mean the following. It says, just as it is impossible for the world to exist without four directions, so too it is impossible for the world to exist without the people of Israel. So it's a very strong claim of the notion that the people of Israel is what actually keeps the cosmos together. It's what allows the universe to exist. And by being sort of this special manifestation of God in the world, Jews perform this very important and essential function. And as if that doesn't already sound enough like, you know, incarnation, it gets close to a Christian doctrine, and clearly the Kabbalists weren't afraid of that because they were using this idea to formulate a conception of Judaism that rejected Christian critiques of Judaism. We also find Judaism, a Jewish text using the idea of the Son of God, that Jews are sons of God. We find them saying this all the time. And in fact, Moshe Idel, the scholar of Jewish mysticism in Israel, wrote a book called Ben, Sonship in Jewish Mysticism. And the book is about 600 pages long because he found so many passages that talk about the idea that the people of Israel are the sons of God or the children of God. They use the term banim. And he said he expected it to be a very short piece of scholarship. And the more work he did, the more he realized Jews talk about the idea that Jews are the sons of God all the time. All the time. They weren't afraid of that idea, but they formulate it not to look like Christianity, but actually as a rejection of Christian claims. So Joseph of Hamadan, the Kabbalist I mentioned, here's an example of him saying this. It is written, you are sons to the Lord your God, Deuteronomy 14:1. And he says, sons truly, mamash in Hebrew, meaning really. He said, to the groom, who is the king, the Lord of hosts, and the bride, the community of Israel. Here he's referring to the groom, the king, is the central sfirah, the sixth one in the world of the sfirot, Tiferet, and the bride is the Shekhinah. And when they come together in a kind of marital embrace, they give birth to sons, which are the souls of Jews. And therefore, Jews are the sons of God. So that notion of sonship and incarnation, Jews embrace these ideas. They talk about them all the time in the pre-modern world. And they do it as a way of reinforcing a traditional conception of Judaism as the people of Israel obligated to perform the commandments of the covenant. It's not, in fact, a way of syncretizing or of becoming similar to Christianity. In fact, it's formulated as rejection of Christian claims about Judaism. It's even possible, I would say, that Christian ideas about the spiritualization of Christianity as opposed to the carnality of Judaism are themselves formulated as a result of their rejection of Judaism. And Judaism and Christianity in this period then formulate one another. The idea of incarnation becomes connected to reincarnation In later forms of Judaism, we find this with the students of Isaac Luria in the 16th century, where they had the notion of Gilgul HaNeshamot, sometimes referred to in English as metempsychosis or reincarnation, and that Jews have to perform certain commandments, and the idea was that each Jewish soul comes from a particular place in God, and that if they perform the special tikkun, the special rectification or adornment that's unique to them, that is the special job for their soul in this world, they can stop being reincarnated and instead can have their soul reassimilated into the place in God where it came from. And that if every Jew can accomplish this, it brings about redemption by reconfiguring the light of God that needs to return from the body. And therefore, actions done with the body are necessary in order to bring about redemption. And if Jews don't perform the right actions, they're forced to be reincarnated. They're forced to be born again. Reincarnation is not actually viewed as a good thing in this system. Reincarnation is the result of some shortcoming, some deed left undone that's necessary in order for them to accomplish what they need to accomplish. So these notions of incarnation and then reincarnation become really important in pre-modern Judaism for thinking about the power of Jewish actions. And now, of course, incarnation can cut both ways. The idea of Jewish incarnation can become a way of thinking about the sanctity of humanity and the power of human actions and of Jewish actions in the world. To wield that kind of power creates almost an anxiety. It's clear that medieval Kabbalists were anxious about it, because they felt tremendously responsible for their important role in the universe. They didn't want to mess it up. They didn't want to destroy the universe or to harm the harmony of God. On the other hand, to imagine Jews as God incarnate can lead to dangerous thinking as well. There's a comment from a rabbi in Israel, Yitzchak Ginsburg, from the Od Yosef Chai settlement, or from Od Yosef Chai Yeshiva in the West Bank. And he wrote a book, he had a chapter in praise of Baruch Goldstein, who had committed a tremendous massacre at the Cave of the Patriarchs. And Ginsburg, who was born in the U.S. originally, he uses the notion of the incarnation of God as a justification for valuing Jewish life above non-Jewish life. And in fact, he even states in one of his writings, he says, quote, "If every simple cell in the Jewish body entails divinity, is a part of God, then every strand of DNA is part of God, and therefore something is special about Jewish DNA. If a Jew needs a liver, can you take the liver of an innocent non-Jew passing by to save him? The Torah would probably permit that. Jewish life has an infinite value." Right? So this is an example of incarnational thinking turned into a very dangerous doctrine that Jewish lives are valuable and Christian lives are not, because Jewish bodies are different than non-Jewish bodies. But at the same time, we find the idea of incarnation being used in Jewish renewal and all sorts of places where it's about the power of human actions and the responsibility that people have and that Jews have to think about the impact of everything that they do, and to imagine that it has much broader implications than what we can see. And I think many of us have had the experience of finding out that our actions had ramifications, had consequences well beyond anything we had ever imagined. And that this is a meditation in the Jewish tradition on the question of the power of our actions. So this powerful idea about Jewish power can have all sorts of consequences, both very, very good ones and very, very bad ones. My hope is that as this idea continues forward, it will be a power that we wield wisely. Thank you very much. And I'm happy for any questions you might have. Any questions? Yes.
point it out and say, well, everybody is Arvindani. Everybody has the soul of God. Everybody has the soul of the self. It's not something special that the Jews usually recognize it. I know that's not in the Zohar. I know that that's a reaction. But can we now, as modern Jews, Reform Jews, some of us, adopt this and say, I love devotion, I embrace it, I just reject the notion that it's only Jews that are special?
Yes, I mean, I don't see why not. But so the question is it possible to spread the idea out from the notion that Jews have a unique divine soul and therefore are uniquely special? Is it possible to sort of democratize that across humanity and imagine that everyone has a divine soul and that this could be a way of elevating the humanity of all people? Well, it's true that some medieval texts really don't do that because they were formulated in a context of rejecting claims from others, right? This is always the difficulty of inheriting texts from the pre-modern world that was just simply much more discriminating in how they articulated the humanity of one group versus another. There actually are plenty of pre-modern texts that do think of every human as manifesting the divine in one form or another, and that the problem with those who criticize Judaism is their lack of recognition of their own divinity. And while they'll still elevate the conception of Judaism as the, having a special role to play, they don't always denigrate the other as being worthless. And those texts, I think, are very useful and could be embraced in all kinds of constructive ways. Yes, those are Jewish texts and Kabbalistic texts that do utilize this idea to imagine the value of every human being, not just of Jewish human beings. But it's also the case that at least if for some of them in the Middle Ages, they're formulated in a polemical context, and so they say very polemical things, as we would perhaps expect. Yes? Oh, sorry, here, first, yes, you, sir, and then you, ma'am. So the question is the especially from the biblical heritage, that it would seem that there's the notion that all people are created in the divine image, that God breathes the soul of life into them, and therefore everyone has the spark of the divine in them. That's a way of formulating that. And so, there's lots of what to work with to create a more universalistic and humanistic doctrine. In polemical environments, they do that less, and in pluralistic environments, they do that more. Interestingly, though the rabbis in the Talmud do embrace the notion that humans reflect the divine, that there's something about the image of God, right? When it says, "Na se adam betzalmenu kidmutenu," let us make God, man in our image according to our likeness. It would imply that there is a divine and a divine retinue that is human-like, and that the human body is in the image of God. But when it says that God breathes the Ruach Haim, the breath of life into humanity, doesn't necessarily carry an incarnational implication. And that when we find Jews later articulating it that way, I think they're trying to emphasize or underscore something specifically about Judaism. But could that then be spread out to a conception of other people? We find lots of Kabbalists in the modern period who do that. Yes, sir. Well, according to some of the Kabbalists who talk about reincarnation, and Hasidim really do talk about this. I once saw a manuscript in the Jewish Theological Seminary when I worked there as a cataloger, and I was a terrible, terrible worker in the manuscript room of the Jewish Theological Seminary. It has one of the best collections of Hebrew manuscripts outside of Israel. And so I was just the worst. I was supposed to be cataloging Hebrew broadsides that were printed in the 18th and 19th century in Israel, and sort of describing what they are and entering it into the computer system. But because no one really was paying that much attention to what I was doing, Rabbi Jerry Schwartzbard, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm really sorry. I spent all my time just reading manuscripts. It was so wonderful. I was back in this vault that was half the size of this room that was just filled with all the kinds of manuscripts you can imagine. And I remember finding one very interesting early Hasidic manuscript. So it was from probably around the maybe second generation of a Hasidim after the Baal Shem Tov, so in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And it talked about what is the Gilgul Neshama, what is the reincarnated fate of people who have performed certain commandments, I mean certain transgressions of the commandments. So a person who, I remember they said, a Jew who eats chametz, who eats leavened products on Passover, that person will be reincarnated as a Christian. A person who there were certain sexual violations where that person would then be reincarnated as an animal. And so there are all these like things, it was just sort of a list of, if you do this, you'll be reincarnated as that. And it was actually written like as a list on a piece of paper, as though someone was going to go to the rabbi and say, Rabbi, I ate pork. And he'll look down and he's like, oh, I'm sorry, you're going to be reincarnated as a Russian. I don't know. They have all these just crazy, it was great. And so the list of reincarnation was about so transgressions result in being reincarnated at a lower level where that person will have to work their way up again. Whereas certain commandments will mean that they'll either be reincarnated at a higher level or, best of all, not need to be reincarnated at all and have their light go back to God. Okay, so let's yeah, it does eventually return to God, but if you're asking about the, especially Kabbalistic ideas about punishment of the soul in the afterlife for bad souls, they don't blink out. Souls don't disappear for them, but they're troubled by this. One very important Kabbalist, Moses de Leon, he actually ponders, how is it possible for the soul to be punished? Because wouldn't that be like God punishing a piece of himself? And they talk about the process of the purification of souls as though they're being sacrificed by the angel Michael, that they're sacrificed into a river of fire, and that they're purified, and they come out from it renewed, refreshed, ready to be assimilated into God. And there it's kind of, I think, an ironic inversion of the notion of hell, which Jews, they had the notion of Gehenna, about temporary punishment, but not the notion of the eternal hell that Christians talk about. And I think that when Moses de Leon talks about this purification by fire, that's almost this loving act of purifying souls through fire to have them come out renewed. In fact, they even talk about every soul at night going up to the divine, to Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, be purified in this fire of a river of fire, and then being reborn into the body every day. That each day the act of creation is regenerated through the reintroduction of souls into bodies as Jews wake up in the morning, and that their souls are purified in a river of fire, I think is a kind of ironic inversion of the notion of the eternal flames of hell that are punishment. These are kind of divine flames that purify and renew the world rather than destroy it. That's one of the ways I think Kabbalists, they negotiate that question. Yes, in green, yes. I'm sorry, I don't know everybody's name, so I'm just using the colors of your attire. Is redeemable. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, so the question is the humanistic notion that there's no essential bad person, there's bad actions. And here I think you have something like that. You need a body to do evil. You also, for the Kabbalists, need a body to do good. That in the absence of the body, there really is no good action possible. The body's necessary to enable that. So bodies that contain souls are just powerful agents in the universe, according to the Kabbalists, capable of tremendous harm or of tremendous good. And that when the body does harm, it really can destroy the fabric of the universe and hinder divine unity, causing the spherot to be separated from one another. And when the body does good, it heals the universe and creates harmony within God's inner self. So these are very, very powerful things in the world. And I think it's actually through the anxiety of that power that Kabbalists sought to encourage Jews to see Judaism as meaningful, powerful, relevant, and not the way Christian critiques describe it, as carnal and meaningless and despiritualized. It's actually, in a sense, extremely spiritualized through the body rather than going around the body. Yes, sir?
We know in the modern and postmodern times there's a huge influence of Eastern religions. Is there any evidence from your studies or what you've read of an influence of Eastern religions during the rabbinic, medieval, and I'm thinking the Lurianic times? Because a lot of this stuff seems to fit with some Eastern senses of incarnation and reincarnation. So is there any evidence that the writers and rabbis were influenced by Eastern religions?
So yes, the question, just be sure we get it on the recording, is there any evidence of the influence of Eastern religions. In rabbinic times and medieval times, there is not good evidence of this, especially the question, I think, here of Hinduism and the question of reincarnation. By the time we get to Luria, it is remarkable that we start to see an emphasis on reincarnation that's hinted at and described in medieval texts, but not prominently at all. And it becomes very central in Isaac Luria's notion of Kabbalah, of achieving tikkun through a process of multiple lives. It's also interesting that Luria was an international trader and traded in goods that were part of the spice route and the silk route, and it does make you wonder about contacts with the East. But this is still a question in the scholarship, and we don't have any clear evidence to suggest that, yes, there is a cross-fertilization of ideas with Hinduism. We know the world was, and especially the world of international trade, was fairly global at that point, and that Hindu trade was important, but we don't have any clear evidence on that yet. Yes?
What happens
So the first question is about how do medieval Kabbalists understand conversion, right? Conversion's embraced as something from Talmudic Judaism and elsewhere. This is clearly a part of Jewish practice, conversion. So how do they relate that to the notion of the divine, uniquely divine soul of the Jew, the special neshama, the soul that comes from Ein Sof through the Sefirot into the Jewish body uniquely? There are sort of two strategies for understanding that. In one case, they talk about the notion of that converts essentially are Jews originally, and they're returning to Judaism because their soul draws them to it, because it was originally a soul from the stock of Jewish souls in the world and was lost to the community at some point, and these souls are returning to their natural home. That's one way of thinking about it. The other is that they kind of think of conversion as not just changing one's religious ideas, but really literally changing the being of oneself, that this changes the nature of a person's body and soul. And so conversion is a process of transformation, and that in that process of transformation, the convert becomes like a Jew. There's some dispute among some Kabbalists about, are they exactly the same or not exactly the same? And people like Yehuda Halevi had a little bit of a harder time with the notion of conversion. But for many Kabbalists, they are able to accommodate the notion of conversion into their notion of sort of the divine character of Jewish humanity, because they saw conversion as being part of the Jewish tradition. Of course, conversion was illegal in medieval Christendom. Jews were not allowed to convert Christians to Judaism. It was against the law of the state. But they still had to think about the idea of conversion. And so through these different strategies, they were able to make conversion capable of rendering a convert identical to a Jew. No, they're just engaging in transgression that's destroying the fabric of the cosmos and the unity of God. So the Kabbalists would see this as having many, many negative ramifications. But it does not mean that that Jewish soul stops being a Jewish soul. They're following the idea in the Talmud that Jews can never, especially a person is born Jewish, that they have emerged from a Jewish woman as their mother. So like it's a very sort of body-centered notion in that respect, that person can never stop being Jewish, no matter what they do. Okay, I believe there is someone who was born Jewish who's a member of the College of Cardinals right now. So there is the potential for a Jewish pope, halachically Jewish pope. That would create all kinds of really interesting, can he lead a Mizuman? Can he have an Aliyah? I don't know. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Given this body versus spirit issue we've been dealing with, do you see that as maybe related to the dominance of halakha over Haggadah?
I think it's for the dominance of halakha, and it's also the dominance of just what we call somatic practice, bodily practice, as what characterizes Judaism, rather than religious dogma. You know, it's interesting, in Catholicism, there developed the several mechanisms for testing the beliefs of followers, where they have to make statements where they affirm certain core religious beliefs with their mind in order to qualify for certain kinds of religious rituals. And we don't see a similar test in rabbinic Judaism really anywhere. There is no moment where a person goes into a synagogue and someone says, wait, do you believe that this Torah was given on Mount Sinai to Moses by God? Do you believe, you know, going through these different beliefs? As long as Jews are kind of doing the same thing, no one really asks what their beliefs are. Even when the Talmud describes the process of conversion, what do they teach? It's not beliefs, it's actually actions. They teach them some of the laws. And by learning the laws, this creates the basis for how they will convert, because conversion means taking on a set of obligations in the Talmudic system, not just a set of beliefs. So I think it's actually the dominance of religious behavior over intellectual religious belief that's reflected in this sort of conception both of humanity and of the purpose of religious life. Is there someone there who I hadn't asked yet? Yes?
I was thinking that when you were talking about incarnation, I was thinking about the Reconstructionist movement. And it seems like that's what they're talking about, that that they don't really believe in the God thing, but that each person has godliness in him. So you think that Reconstructionism just kind of borrowed that idea?
I don't know. I'm not sure if that was Kaplan's intention, but the notion of the divine being manifest in the human is important to a lot of different streams of Judaism, pre-modern and contemporary. Sort of the sanctity of the person. I think that that's something that is not new within rabbinic Judaism. I think it's following a heritage. Yes? So the question is, does the notion of reincarnation, is that reflected in the idea that the Messiah is present in every generation? So there is a statement in the Talmud that the Messiah was born on the day the temple was destroyed. The idea is that this messianic soul, this messianic figure is present in every generation, and if that generation is worthy and merits the arrival of messianic redemption, the Messiah is there and present and always ready to go. And so that idea is there. The what we find in the Lurianic Kabbalistic idea of reincarnation, that souls are performing certain tasks that are unique to them, and when they accomplish them, their soul ascends up into heaven. It's actually less focused on the ideal person of the Messiah. It kind of sees the Messiah as a collective activity, wherein if every Jew performs their proper function, they will all cause their souls to be elevated and to reconfigure the light of the Adam Kadmon, the primordial anthropomorphic figure of God, and that will usher in redemption. So there it's much more of a collective rather than individual act that creates messianic redemption, but that collective redemption is the result of the successive lives of Jews trying to finally succeed in liberating their souls and reconstructing the divine light as it was at the time of creation. Yes? One last question. Actually, Sephardi. It was Western, so it was in Spain. So the Sephardim get full honors on this one.
Okay. I've been traveling in the eastern part of the world and had exposure to the Jews from India, China, Southeast Asia. And I'm kind of wondering where all of that fits, because you made the comment of a Jewish soul born to a Jewish mother, yet those Jews were patriarchal, not matriarchal. So I'm kind of wondering, is there a place for them to go together, or is this a sort of a separate concept?
Well, they are drawing on different traditions, and the Kabbalah that begins in Spain spreads very quickly. We start to see Ashkenazi manuscripts that preserve Kabbalah within the 13th and early 14th centuries. So the Kabbalah becomes embraced by Sephardic, Ashkenazi, and other Jews. They didn't always think of themselves that way quite in those terms in that period. But it spreads very quickly. But the patriarchal versus matriarchal sense of lineage, that's following a more biblical rather than a rabbinic conception about, you know, patriarchy versus matriarchy, where it's actually matriarchal in the rabbinic system of the Talmud and patriarchal in the biblical one. I think that Kabbalah had a little bit less of a penetration into the communities of the Far East. Like the Kaifeng community, I don't think we have any Kabbalistic manuscripts from them. But at the same time, the impact that these ideas may have had in those communities, I think it's hard to say. I mean, much of the discourse that Jews have engaged in over the centuries is actually lost to us. We don't have a perfect preservation of our literature, and of course, conversations are ephemeral and then gone. So it's an interesting question about the ways that those ideas might have functioned, but for lack of more evidence, it's hard to say. Well, thank you very, very much. Thank you for inviting me.